This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2016, held at Faith Builders on August 1 through 5.
Authority, they rise up. Were they close to having a revolution? I do not know. But I imagine that there were people who thought to themselves, you know, this is wrong and we must do something. We cannot just sit here and let this go. You've heard of this quote. The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. That quote has been driving people to action for 200 plus years. Because it sounds so right. And you feel so shameful to be sitting there doing nothing and allowing evil to triumph. And so men begin to look around. Who is the man that could lead us to do something and right these wrongs? Did anyone think of David? He was the military hero. The women sing that he's more powerful than Saul. Well, there's another something interesting about David. Saul's not the only man in Israel that's anointed. David is anointed. So we could almost imagine this as a commission from God to rise up and do something. I don't know if men were tapping David on the shoulder and saying, David, you must do something. Could David have done something? David faces an incredibly tough test here. One of the toughest tests that men ever face. You probably won't face it to the extent that David did. But God does allow us to be tested like this sometimes, especially men. And I want you to think about that God seemingly stood back and gave David these options. And then put him on display, and almost it's like God stood back and said, okay, everybody, let's see how this man will respond. Let's see if he chooses option A, B, or C. And so, since David is anointed of the Lord, we could almost imagine that as commissioned to go do something. And since he is stronger than the king anyway, he should, A, carry out a military coup and overthrow King Saul. And restore. B, write and speak behind the scene in order to turn the people against King Saul until there's a revolution and we can get him out of here. Or C, run away all by himself and hide, even though it could easily ruin his reputation as a leader. How easy David could have done option A. I don't know where David learned how to write, but you've read the Psalms. David could write. How easily David could have did option B. And I wonder if he struggled to choose option C. And the other question is, would it have been okay for David to do option A? Now, David, we studied already, wanted to see things the way God saw them. And he was willing to wait until he knew what God knew. And there's an interesting verse in 1 Samuel 22:3. David is already running at this point, and he takes his parents down to the country of Moab. And he tells the people in Moab, would you take care of my parents? And then he has a very interesting phrase. Would you take care of my parents until I know what God will do for me? And this was a frustrating test for David because he didn't know. I guess at this point, David just wanted to know, what do you want me to do? Do you want me to be like Jehu and go out and slay the house of Ahab? In Jehu's case, that's what God wanted him to do. But here's David, and God just sort of stood back and said, here's a test. What will he choose? Will this man be like most other men and choose power? Or do I finally have a man who is going to rule my people correctly? Is this the kind of man that could just, even though he's the most powerful man in the nation, he could just walk away from power? See, Saul didn't work out. Something was wrong with Saul. Somewhere power got the best of Saul. And now God stands here and puts David on display. Is it going to be power? Or can you live without it? Can you trust me with the power and walk away? Now, in the heat of the moment, it is so hard to know what needs to be done, especially when people are screaming that quote, the triumph of evil is going to happen if good men don't do something. And when you're the strongest man in the kingdom, to stand there and say, no, but I don't have a word from the Lord yet. We have to wait. And just to run. It is hard to know in the middle of difficult situations like this how God is working and what God would want us to do. And we wrestle through these things on our knees. We pray. These are difficult tests for us. I had an interesting conversation over Memorial Day this last May with a local fire chief. I live right beside the runway of our airport, and so I get to watch the airplanes land. And on Memorial Day, they were flying in their last remaining flyable B-29 with those big, incredibly sounding engines. And here it comes. And the fire chief is a history buff and a World War II buff. And so he wanted to video this plane landing with that sound, an incredible sound. And so he came to my house to video this. And the plane was late arriving. It was about 2 hours late. So we stood there and talked about World War II and history. And after talking a long time, he looked at me and he said, I've studied all different kinds of people groups. You Mennonites have it right. Of all the people, the Mennonites, they are living in the community the right way. And I said, even though we don't fight? And he said, well, yeah, that's kind of a strange one. Yes, it's true that if everybody in the world was a Mennonite, then no one would fight. And I think, ha ha. But he said, you know, that's not reality. Somebody has to take care of the Hitlers. Now, what does a good little Mennonite boy say to that? How would you respond to that? Somebody has got to take care of the Hitlers. Well, I knew what I wanted to say. You know, you always think later what you should have said. I help at prison. We go hold Bible studies with prison. It happens to be about every time. Oh, I wish I would have said it differently. But anyway, I knew what I wanted to say, but I knew he was going to interpret it wrongly. So I said it anyway. I said, well, I believe that God will raise up people to take care of the Hitlers. But you know what he did with that? Oh, yes, absolutely. That's why we Americans went over there and took care of him. Actually, he took care of himself, didn't he? But helped fight that war because there were terrible things happening and people were being murdered unfairly. And so we, the West, had to get over there and do something. And that's the way it has to be. And, you know, I suppose someday God will raise up someone to take care of America. And When that happens, how will we view that person? Will we view them the same way we viewed Hitler? I don't know. In the heat of that moment in Israel, in the gates of Israel, when Saul had just slain all those priests in the city of Nob, remember that? He went in there and he did even worse than slay him himself. He had a foreigner slay them. Terrible disgrace. That has got to be one of the worst things that that a king ever did in Israel, slay all the priests of God. I can imagine if I were a good Israelite, that would have really fired me up. What are we going to do? And if you would have walked in on that conversation and said, well, but I think maybe God raised up Saul to judge the house of Eli. Poof. They would have probably hit you over. That just wasn't what they were ready to hear. They were concentrating about Saul and his terrible atrocities. To actually think that God's plan might be to judge the house of Eli, it still even today feels a little wrong. And these, we jump to conclusions so fast about what we think God has in mind. And David, interestingly, said, I'm not sure we know. And until we know, I'm out of here. And he runs. Now, I have another quote here that I want you to think a little bit about. From Francis Bacon. I guess I should have put the word sir in front of that, right? Sir Francis Bacon. Prosperity is the blessing of the Old Testament. Adversity is the blessing of the New. And of course, we're in New Testament. We don't like these kind of quotes to think about adversity being a blessing. But this is what made David's test so tough. He could have done the military coup so easily. God may have even allowed him to do it. I think God would have been disappointed because he'd have chosen power. He could have chosen prosperity for himself, privilege for his people, prestige for the nation, and all kinds of power. But instead, he runs away into adversity and chooses for himself, deliberately put away prosperity and power, and chose for himself adversity. One of the toughest. We even as New Testament people struggle to do this. We get all excited about the nature of Christ. We love to take on the nature of Christ, but do we like to take on his lifestyle? Not really. We all of a sudden like to kind of divide the thing. We like the prosperity of the Old Testament and the nature of Jesus in the New Testament. But Jesus is not a divided person. If you take his nature, don't be surprised if you end up taking his lifestyle. And so David is living not like a natural man, but like a spiritual man, and very much like a New Testament man, experiencing what is something very much like a future son of his, Jesus Christ. So this is the test. Now, the first verse I'd like to look at here is 1 Samuel 21, verse 1. And notice some things about it. Then came David to Nob, to Ahimelech the priest. And Ahimelech was afraid at the meeting of David and said unto him, why art thou alone and no man with thee? Now this goes back to looking at how David saw beyond people and climbing the social ladder to trusting his God. The strongest, most powerful man in the nation of Israel fled all alone. And he did not need the security of a following. And that impresses me. Can you name me another person in history who was the most powerful man in his nation and fled away all alone and did not need the security of a following? If you can think of one, I'd like to know about that person. Let's look at another verse. 1 Samuel 22, verses 1 and 2. Now David fled alone, but he was just too well known, too well respected. People were still kind of like to think about that option down there, that fugitive down there, what he could possibly do for the country. And so he could not stay alone. David therefore departed thence and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brethren and all his father's house heard it, they went down thither to him. And everyone that was in distress, and everyone that was in debt, and everyone that was discontented gathered themselves unto him, and he became a captain over them. And there were with him about 400 men. David's test just increases. Remember, David is looking for what God is going to do through him and how God is going to use him. And you know how we look for, you know, we lay out the fleece, so to speak, and we wonder, Lord, show us a sign. How easy do you think it would have been for David to think, this is my sign. I fled away all alone. I passed the test. And now God sent me an army. Yes, this is it. This is what I needed. Now I have direction from God to go back and fight a revolution. The revolutionaries found David. But instead of taking them back to fight against Saul, he still is not sure. But he begins to work with these men in an amazing way. Here is where David begins to demonstrate that he really is a good leader. And tomorrow we'll look more into David's leadership characteristics. But these men are, they come with baggage. And they come with disrespect. And later we're going to look at a verse in the Psalms that says that their hearts were set on fire. And they could have easily moved David in a direction. But he just stood up and became a captain over them. And when you read that phrase, became a captain over them, there's a tremendous amount of care in that phrase. Became a captain over them. He refused to let them push him around. When I think about this scene, I think about the picture in the Bible storybook that I read to my children. They're in a cave, and David's standing in the entrance of the cave in front of all these beggarly men. He's standing up there with this very serene look on his face, and he has his harp in his hand. And he's bringing calmness to their soul. And because David is at rest, though he's a fugitive, and those men find what they're looking for. They don't leave. He will turn those men into loyal men. Now, I'd like to leave that one. Maybe we'll come back to that idea later when we look at Psalm 57. For now, let's look at 1 Samuel 26, verses 9 through 11. And David faces another test. And I think he could have said, now the Lord has opened the doors. And David said unto Abishai, destroy him not. For who can stretch forth his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? David said furthermore, as the Lord liveth, the Lord shall smite him, or his day shall come to die, or he shall descend into battle and perish. The Lord forbid that I should stretch forth mine hand against the Lord's anointed. David here, I think, establishes one of the highest standards in the Bible for respect for anointed authority. I'd like to examine that a little bit. But first of all, we'll put the other observation up here. In David's mind, God had ordained Saul to the position. And in David's mind, God could just as well ordain his removal from the position. Again, notice that David's vision went far beyond himself to a God who was in control. David's trust is incredible here. He is willing to trust God, that God knew what he was doing with King Saul. And the nation of Israel was in God's hands. And God could even keep Israel's safe even in the hands of a tyrant king. Now, how is it that David came to hold anointed authority in such high regard, or ordained authority in such high regard? How is it that David arrived at that point? Do you think it has something to do with the way he was raised? Do you think Dad raised him right? I don't know how David was raised. How were you raised? I grew up in an old school Mennonite home. I don't know how many of you are familiar with an old school Mennonite home, but in my home, there was very little dialogue. Today, it's dialogue, dialogue, dialogue. I mean, lots of dialogue. And people still don't understand. Well, back in my day, there was one sentence, and we understood. When I went to school, my dad said, "Now, if you get a spanking at school, you get a spanking at home." And I didn't even ask why. End of story. I made it all the way to fifth grade. We sat in those little cubby holes. Any of you all sit in those things in school? Ryan did. Some more of you? We sat in those little things. People wonder why I'm so narrow-minded. It's because I got tunnel vision. And my teacher was determined that I was a daydreamer, and he was going to knock it out of me. I wasn't getting my work done. And it came to the last straw, and he whipped me. And he didn't bother to call my parents and tell me that that's what he did. Don't you dare do that today. He didn't bother calling my parents and telling them that he had to whip me. And so I didn't bother telling my parents either. I told my brother, "Don't you dare tell." I had to do all kinds of favors for my brother for the next weeks. It went 9 weeks. 9 whole weeks, a whole quarter. And finally, for political advantage, my brother told on me. Now, do you, after 9 weeks, still spank? You know, I think if you read the books, they might say that's psychologically dangerous. But my dad didn't know anything about psychologically. And so he said, "Really? Oh." And he didn't even call the teacher. He just got up and got his board and spanked me. And you know, the amazing thing is, I was not upset at him. I was upset at my brother, but I wasn't upset at him. I do not have any bitterness toward my dad today. Do you think I'm scarred for life? No. Do you think I'm proud about my upbringing? Entirely too much so. And that can be a snare to us. When I started teaching, I became a teacher and a principal and a dad all in the same month. That was a straight up learning curve. And most of you are single, okay? So when you go into the classroom, your only experience with discipline and child training is how your parents raised you. And if you were raised like I was raised, you're in for a surprise. You're going to see some really interesting things. People train their children all kinds of ways. And you all that were raised like I was, are going to be tempted to say, "This is nuts. I mean, we're going to do this old school around here. We're going to shake this up." And your great upbringing just may get you in trouble. That happened to me. And so be careful about that. Your training. And I am very thankful for my upbringing. My dad taught me how to respect authority. But that can only take us so far. Don't trust in that entirely. Parents do what they do, but one of the fundamental principles of the way we do education is that ultimately we believe in transformation. The public school system doesn't believe that way. They believe in reformation. They take a little kindergartner and just keep improving him until he's 12th grader. An unconverted kindergartner is no different than an unconverted 12th grader, which is actually more dangerous. I would say the unconverted 12th grader. We are different. We believe that ultimately God must change the heart. David had this level of respect for authority because he was a spiritual man, because God had did a work in his heart. And by the way, for all of those of you here who are kind of embarrassed about your upbringing, that maybe dad and mom didn't set the best example, take heart in that. God can change you, and he can give you an outlook toward authority like David had. And I think that is very important for teachers to consider. You know, we teachers have more authority figures than anyone else in the community. You know, name them off. The ministry, the board, the principal, the other parents. You are going to answer to so many different people. Are you at rest with authority in your life? And you know, someday they're going to tell stories about you. Because you're putting your life on display. And someday your students are going to tell stories about you. I hear them in high school. I always wonder how many I should allow. How much should I allow them to talk about their teachers? And by the time the students get to 11th and 12th grade and they start talking about Miss So-and-so down in second grade, they'll say, I could use the positive one or the negative one. I guess we'll go with the positive one. Miss So-and-so, she was the best teacher. We just loved her. Why did you like her? Was it her bulletin boards? I don't remember what kind of bulletin boards she put up. You forget the bulletin boards? Yeah. Well, do you know how many hours she invested in those bulletin boards? I don't know. You don't remember them? No, forget them. Was it her teaching style? I don't know. You mean you don't remember her teaching style? Maybe a little. Well, why do you like her? And the more you question, the more you realize, you know, they don't really even know how to put into words why they like them, that person. But they like them. And this is the thing that followed, this is the reputation this teacher had. She's liked, but there's this mysterious thing that they don't really know why they're liked. They forget the teaching style. They forget the stories they told. They forget the bulletin boards. Shame on them. But for some reason, they like her. Why? Well, see, I remember that teacher. I was around long enough to remember that teacher. I remember when she came to school. She came every day with a big smile on her face. The girl was at rest with life. She was at rest with her church. She was at rest with her parents. And that created a wholesome environment, a wholesome nest in which effective learning happened. And I don't like it, but my enduring legacy just may have a lot to do with how at rest I was with God and with church and with my parents and with the president. I remember as a young man, some of my friends came and said, "You know what the ministry are doing? It is wrong." And I got all worried. Boy, that sounds terrible. The ministry, they're doing something wrong. And I was the oldest in the family, and I maybe a little bit out of touch with church issues, and I just maybe wasn't quite tuned in. And my parents didn't talk about it. They were kind of quiet, like I said. So I didn't know what to do with this. They were telling me the ministry was wrong. So I went home with this dilemma. I tried to get the ministry side. Well, they didn't seem wrong to me. Their side seemed to make sense. But then I would hear these stories. It is wrong. And so I went home to try to figure out this. I gotta decide before God, Lord, are my ministry right or are they wrong? If you'll help me know that, then I'll know what I need to do. But I need to know, are they right or are they wrong? Do you think God ever answered that question for me? Well, I got to looking at David's life, and I realized that in David's experience, Saul was clearly wrong. Would anyone argue with that? He was wrong. And David had the audacity to call Saul the anointed of the Lord. And I will not raise up my hand against him. And I thought, you know, the issue is not whether my ministry are right or wrong. Now, somewhere, somebody has to help leadership think through when power has got the better of them. Yeah, there's all kinds of issues like this. Samuel was that person for King Saul. Interestingly, Samuel left Saul and wouldn't come to the day of his death. Samuel was that person, and apparently David recognized that. But David recognized he was not that person to go set the leadership in straight. And he was able to see beyond this faulty leadership into a God who was firmly in control. This nation, this church, this school is not going to go to pieces if we can see past faulty leadership into a God that is sovereign and is in control of all things. And he put these people here in place and authority, and he can take care of them when he will and how he will. There is a psalm that David wrote when he was in the cave. It is Psalm 57. And I just took a few of those verses, not the entire psalm, but just a few of them for us to look at here, to be blessed by David's response and outlook here in the midst of his incredible test. What do you do when you're in the middle of this test? And God is kind of standing back, seeing how you're going to respond. It's interesting to me that David does three things here. He cries out for mercy. He affirms to God that his heart is fixed and no man will move it. And he worships. When there's nothing else to do, and you could talk for 5 or 6 hours hashing this whole thing out and trying to figure out where we're going, you know, you could just save that. Just bow your heart before God and worship. Be merciful unto me, O God. Be merciful unto me. For my soul trusteth in thee. Yea, in the shadow of thy wings will I make my refuge until these calamities be overpast. Verse 4. My soul is among lions. Those men with all that baggage, and their hearts are set on fire. Even among them that are set on fire, even the sons of men whose teeth are spears and arrows and their tongue a sharp sword. This is what David is putting up with every day, and he must breathe his peace on them every day. There's a better way, men. And then he leads them into worship. Let's look up. Be thou exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let thy glory be above all the earth. Verse 7, my heart is fixed. O God, my heart is fixed. Fixed, I will sing and give praise. And then he repeats verse 5 again. Be thou exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let thy glory be above all the earth. Some of you will go back and teach in communities this year that are embroiled in church difficulties. Maybe. And that can be a tough one. Some of your children will come. I can imagine the high school scenario. Some children will come sons of ministers. Some children will come sons of parents who are against the ministers. And I can imagine that would be about just like a cave experience. How do you respond to those conversations, because children represent their parents so accurately. What are you going to say? What are you going to say to the son of the dad who is against the minister, that you do not turn his heart against his dad, nor do you turn his heart against his minister? Maybe you should just say, boys, let's turn to Psalm 57. Let's sing a song. Let's worship God. For sure, we all find ourselves in the middle of national. Are you looking forward to this fall election, helping your students through Clinton and Trump issues? We already had it last year. I'm sure you did too. And I told my boys last year, I said, listen, their talk was very disrespectful. And they said, but Brother Linford, they're not in authority yet. They're just still campaigning, right? But boys, this fall, it's going to be different. One of those people is going to be your president. Lord willing, be good if, real nice if a lawyer would come before then. We're going to have to get used to this. One of those people, you're going to say, president, or don't you make them put president in front of it? Do you say President Obama or just Obama? President Clinton or President Trump. And you're going to have to help them be respectful. And that's not the only issue. Is the flag flying at full mast today? And there's LGBT issues and tolerance doctrine and Black Lives Matter and terrorism and so many things. And how are you going to help them think through that? And what is the correct response? Be thou exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let thy glory be above all the earth. Lord bless you as you face those challenges.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.